All right, Mr. Wise, what were your expectations as you prepared to leave basic training?
Well, at that point, we didn't know where we would be assigned, and we were just hoping we'd get to a good division, a good unit.
What kind of moods did you see in other people around you?
They were all about the same, just hoping for a good job somewhere. But we didn't know. We were pretty sure we'd be headed for combat units. But, of course, and we'll get to it later, another reason that I'm still here is because I was assigned to battalion staff rather than the line rifle companies.
Okay. And what was it like being part of the U.S. Army's first usage of airborne units?
Oh, it was... we were still experimenting, used them in three times before, so they had an idea of how to work it. And they were at that point the airborne units. As a second lieutenant, you could depend on any of your men to take over your job. They were all trained and they were veterans. They knew what they were doing, and it was worth it to be in an airborne division.
And where were you stationed at first?
We went overseas. We landed in Scotland and moved down to England. And the 82nd was quartered in Leicester, England, just outside of London.
And we have in front of us here, Mr. Wise, a model of one of these gliders. Can you explain to me what a glider was and how it functioned?
Well, this is called a Waco glider, W-A-C-O, and it was similar to a Piper or a Cessna airplane with a metal frame and canvas over it. And was built so that the nose was on a hinge. They could lift the tire nose up and back, even a Jeep, into it. And it had the capacity of carrying 13 soldiers, or a Jeep and two or three men. And the one I went to Holland in had a two-wheeled scooter and about six of us in the unit. So they're different size. And it was just pulled by a C-47 or transport plane, and you were hooked. There were release points at the airplane and the glider, so that when you got to your landing zone, the pilot just tripped a switch and unhooked the glider, and then the tow plane would unhook his, and the tow rope would drop to the ground. That was a nylon rope that was about 30 feet long to start with, and when they were towing him, it stretched out to about 200 yards or something like that as you went through the air. And the pilot had a telephone. The only communications the two pilots had was a telephone down the tow rope. They didn't have radios or anything like that. They only had five instruments. They had an altimeter, landing speed, something else. But there weren't a lot of controls. And when they cut you loose, you made a 360-degree turn in about 25 or 30 seconds and hit the ground. Because if you're in combat zone, there are people shooting at you. And these were slow. They had the airspeed indicator had a red flag at 125 miles an hour. That's as fast as they could go. So, but they were pretty useful, and they got rid of them as soon as the war ended, because they're not that. The helicopters developed so fast, and there's some, the helicopters make so much more sense now.
Yeah.
The 101st Airborne Division now, they are paratroopers, but they also are Air Assault, and they ride the big helicopters. The 82nd Airborne is still just a parachute regiment.
Okay. Now, when you took your first trip in one of those, what did they say to you when they were loaded?
They said, "Hang on," because these are, you know, with a canvas covering, just metal strips. They flapped and rattled and they bounced we our first ride we were supposed to take one ride every month, but a lot of times they weren't available, so they would take you up off the ground to about 900 feet or so, make one circle and cut you loose, and you went down and landed. And they bounced and rattled and shook, and everybody was scared to death the first ride.
Did you see any looks of astonishment from anybody else that kind of reminded you, of being kids again?
Everybody felt the same way. And because they lost so many in the Normandy invasion, when I reported, they didn't have any available for training. The first one I saw was the day we went out to get in them to ride to Holland.
And what battles were you engaged in, Rick?
Well, I rode on the airborne invasion of Holland. We took off from England and landed in Holland. We were there for about 6 weeks, and one thing about the airborne units, you have assignments to do. You have a mission. When that's through, they pull you back and you go to base camp and get resupplied and refurbished and wait for your next mission. So we were we went in September and went back to base camp the end of October, and were there until December when the Battle of Bulge hit. And the two airborne divisions were the first two called up to try and stop the Battle of the Bulge. And you've heard of the 101st being at Bastogne. And we were in the same shape, only the 82nd was on the north side of the bulge. And we held that side. And to give you an idea of the airborne's ability to move, I was at that time, I was battalion S2 intelligence officer, and we were at a movie at 8:30 at night in base camp in France. The lights came on, and everybody report back to your units immediately, and I was with the advance guard to go up and locate the division. We left at 1 o'clock in the morning, headed for Belgium, didn't know where we were going or what we'd find. The whole division hit the road in trucks at 6 o'clock the next morning. And the 101st did the same thing. So from 8:30 at night till 6:30 in the morning, they had quartermaster trucks there, and they drove us up to Belgium.
And what would you say, as far as compared to all the other different ways people can go into combat, what was it like to glide?
Well, it was scary. And the thing about it, the intelligence wasn't always right. Now, for example, when they went to Normandy, they didn't realize that you couldn't land in the hedgerow country. And I don't know why. The French had all kinds of intelligence people, but they were trying to land gliders in these little hedgerows that they thought they could fly through. They thought the hedgerows were just bushes, but they were 10 to 20 feet of dirt, piles of dirt, and the gliders crashed into them, and also the Germans had put poles up in the middle of these fields, kind of short telephone poles that. And they had a terrible job with them, and they never should have used those landing zones at all. They were all right for paratroopers, but they killed an awful lot of glider people and broke up gliders because they didn't realize what the landing zone consisted of. In fact, there's this book, Silent Wings, said that there were about 800 gliders used, and when they went into, after the battle was over, to recover the usable ones, they only found 14 that they could jerk out and return that were flyable.
Wow.
They all hit buildings or hedgerows or posts or trees, and so it was kind of scary. But now we, on my landing in Holland, they cut us loose early because they were shooting tow planes down, and we landed on a bombed out landing strip and had no problems. Of course, we were about 40 miles short of where we were headed for Holland. We landed in Belgium and had about 4:30 in the afternoon and had to walk till about 6:30 the next morning to get where we were supposed to be.
Now, how do you think gliders made an impact during World War II?
Well, they supported the paratrooper. The idea is that the paratroopers would go in, capture the landing zone, because all the paratroopers had was rifles and machine guns and light. They didn't have any heavy equipment at all. So the idea was the paratroopers would go in, open up the landing zone. The gliders would come in. We actually had some anti-tank guns and some small artillery pieces and jeeps and extra ammunition that we brought. So we would be the support for the paratroopers and give them a bunch of people, a bunch of bodies to help whatever problems they were in.
And what problems were there in glider units, and how did you fix them?
Well, the problem is the landing zones, and they never did fix them.
Pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah, and that was due to the intelligence that they didn't have. Now, the last glider assault was over the Rhine River. It must have been about March of 44, and they were in open country and farms and things, and they didn't have any problems at all. The 17th Airborne Division went in there, and their glider regiment was the 327th, I think. Mine was the 325th. So, and they, as you know, they got rid of gliders as soon as they could, as soon as the helicopters proved workable.
And how was it working side by side with parachute regiments?
Well, they appreciated us, and we appreciated them. We didn't. They kind of looked down their noses at glider riders because they hadn't been through jump school. Jump school is one of the toughest things you can do in about 2 weeks. Make five jumps. In fact, when it took the paratroopers, the men got $50 a month, and the officers got $100 a month jump pay. And it took them quite a while before they got it to the glider rider. They weren't giving them the jump pay. Finally, they just figured out that they were doing the same job, so they got the gliders finally got the jump pay that they should have had all along, because it was actually probably more dangerous landing than the paratroopers.
I would think, especially when you have that much covered around
you.
And what are some of your memories in the service as far as...
Well, the main one was that ride to Holland, and then first live German I saw was from an observation post in just south of Nijmegen, and we were on a little hill that... Had a windmill beside it, and I was up on the top of a windmill, and the Germans were a quarter of a mile across a little gully up on the other side, and watched them. And then we had some pretty tough fighting. The airborne invasion of Holland was a total disaster because Bernard Montgomery, Field Marshal Montgomery, rushed it through. And it wasn't planned right. They didn't have the time to plan it, or they didn't have the intelligence. He was competing with General Patton. Have you seen the movie Patton? Well, at this time Patton was down in France getting all the headlines. Montgomery couldn't stand it, so he planned this. The idea was to go north of the German main force and cross the Rhine there and then come in from northern Germany and try to cut off a bunch of German stuff. But the he sacrificed his 1st British Airborne Division. He dropped the main bridge across the Rhine River was at Nijmegen, and the 101st and the 82nd dropped from Belgium up there, and Montgomery was supposed to come through with his tanks. We were supposed to hold that ground for 3 to 5 days, and then Montgomery would come in and take, and he dropped the British 1st Airborne Division on the other side. Didn't know that that was an R&R zone for a German Panzer Division, with tanks and the whole bit. They were there, and they dropped the British 1st Airborne Division on top of them, and they lost the whole division. About 15-20% of them were killed, and all the rest of them were captured, because they didn't. All they had was machine guns against tanks, and they couldn't hold out.
Now we know, as with anybody else, when you're in some of these foreign lands, even though there are people that you would deem dangerous there, there are going to be other people that you would say are maybe innocent bystanders.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What kinds of conversations or interaction did you have with these kinds of people? What do you remember?
The Dutch people were very friendly. In fact, the Dutch government is the House of Orange, and we had orange patches that we put on, and along with, we had American flag, of course, but the Dutch patriots all put orange sweaters on or handkerchiefs or something, and they were very friendly, eager to see us, and they were helpful, whatever they could. We couldn't understand them, but a lot of them did speak English, you find, but they were happy to have us, because they'd been occupied for years. So
the ones that did speak English, what kinds of things did they say to you?
Oh, they're happy to have us. Just what do you need? What can we do? The thing about it, they didn't have much to give,
but they were still willing.
They were willing, and we gave them as much as we could of our rations. And they liked our K rations and chocolate bars and things. They're wonderful people.
And what did you do for recreation while you were over in these different parts of the world?
Not much. Drink is about the only thing you could do. And our guys, they sampled everything from champagne to potato gin or something. You know, the American GI is very adaptable.
Absolutely.
They are the most wonderful guys in the world, and if you're out somewhere, give them a 10-minute break. They'd start a fire, cook coffee, take a 5-minute nap before the 10 minutes was up. And if there's anything to drink around, they would have a bottle of it.
What would you say, Ray, most summarizes your time over there?
Well, getting through it, getting the job done. And tell you one thing, I had a sergeant who spoke German. He was from Wisconsin, and his family had been in the United States. I think his folks were second generation Americans, but they came from Cologne, Germany, and they spoke, but his folks still spoke German around the house. And we were out, when we got to Cologne, we were in a part of it, and we were trying to locate houses to use and find out what around. We went, knocked on one door, and my sergeant started talking to this lady. Came to her. She was a motherly type, probably 60 years old or so, and real nice lady. And he was talking a while there, and I noticed he was having problems talking to her. I says, what's the matter? What are you talking about? He said, I'm talking to my mother. I said, what do you mean? My folks came from Cologne. This lady looks like my mother. Her accent is my mother's, and it just is, I can't stand it. I got to go. So that's how close, you don't realize, but that's how close we were to the German people. The German people were just like Montanans. And the countryside looks like Montana. So sometimes we wondered whether we were fighting the right people. But it's just the difference between the military and the civilian population. But my sergeant, he couldn't stand it with this lady's accent and her looks. Because they're like Montanans, the Germans. And I think more so, you get down in the southern Bavaria in the mountains and the trees and everything.
We have your uniform sitting out here with us, Ray. You want to kind of give us a walkthrough?
Well, the airborne units, just by their nature, get assigned tough jobs. So the 82nd and the 101st, I have one orange shoulder wrap that was the unit citation from the Netherlands, and on the left shoulder I have a red and green fourgere, a big rope that was the unit citation from Belgium, and we also have one that I don't have on this year. It was blue and white from France, and also have the U.S. Unit identification over the left pocket, and of course I have as a glider rider, I have the glider badge similar to the parachute badge on top. I had a Bronze Star, a Purple Heart, 3 combat ribbons with 3 battle signatures, and an arrowhead which designates a combat invasion. Air combat invasion, and then I have the combat infantryman's badge on, and this is about half of what the average 82nd veteran would have on there, because they would have more combat badges and other. I think I'm entitled to a victory medal, and there's one other that I've never bothered to get. And of course, on the rifle insignia, I have the 325 above the crossed rifles, which was my regiment, and then the 82nd patch on the corner, and this was our regimental insignia. Let's go! And actually, the 82nd was a World War I division. Prior to World War I, most of the Army divisions came from areas. There was the Pennsylvania 5th or the Massachusetts 2nd and the Virginia 3rd and things like that. And they found out that they were too individualistic. So they formed the first two divisions in World War I. With the 82nd, which is the double A, means all American, and the Rainbow Division, which was the 69th, is the rainbow patch, which signified that the men came from all parts of the United States. And since then, the divisions are recruited, you know, people are assigned from all over the country. And so that's where the 82nd patch and the 325th was a World War I division, regimental number. The parachute numbers are in the 500s, 501 on up to, because to distinguish them from the infantry units, the regular infantry units. So
the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart.
Yeah, I got in the Battle of the Bulge. By that time, I was operations officer, Battalion S3, and we were on the move out in an open area, and there was a German tank off to the left of us shooting at a couple of tank destroyers that were in front of us, and one round went crooked and lit about 25 or 30 feet from where I was. There was four or five of us standing in a group talking like we are now, and knocked all of us down. It was the only thing that saved our lives with it was an anti-tank round instead of a high explosive round, and I got a piece of shrapnel in my leg. Lucky nothing happened to me, but the fellow that was 6 feet away from him, when we tried to get, he couldn't get up because his leg was gone, just above the ankle. And the strain, he was in shock. It didn't bleed. It didn't hurt. He didn't even know it was gone at that point. But that's how, then I was just lucky. They sent me back to the aid station and took some shrapnel out and bandaged it and sent me back. They said, get out of here. We've got people that are hurt. But it gave me the Purple Heart and 5 points towards enough to get home. At that time, you needed 50 points and you could go home. And the Bronze Star, we were attacking in northern Germany, and our battalion had two companies going forward, and there was another unit off to the side of us, and we lost track of them. Somehow our companies went the wrong way or something, and they told me to go find that other unit, so I did and got shot at, and finally got them and our people pointed right and closed the gap between the companies, and I got the Bronze Star for that. So.
You mentioned that point system. What other kinds of things?
I was over there. I got four hash marks, which are 6 months overseas duty. I think you got 5 points for each of those, and you got 5 points for medals and Purple Hearts and for time overseas. And I don't remember all the point system, but it had to get to 50, and you were supposed to have a chance to go home, but it didn't always work.
A chance, yeah.
Because when the war ended, you remember they had they gave Berlin to the Russians, basically, and which was a big mistake because Roosevelt and Churchill gave in to Stalin at their big conference, and they never should have, but they wanted control over Berlin, so they picked four countries, each picked a division. The Russians, French, English, and the United States, and they picked the 82nd to be the American. They divided Berlin into four zones, and we were the policemen for that zone inside the Russian area. And scary thought, this was, the war over there ended in April, was it, I think, and we were there in the fall, and they started talking that the two airborne divisions would not go home, they would go east to Japan. But luckily that didn't happen, so we got to come home. But we were about 6 months in, about 3 months in Berlin, just on guard duty in our portion of Berlin. And what a mess that was. You can't believe it, that if they'd ever rebuild it. It was just rubble. No streets or anything. The biggest problem was trying to find ways to drive. We had set up checkpoints all around our area and spread out, so just for control. And it was a hard time getting back and forth with jeeps and things.